This is the Astro Refresher Course 2020, Tumors of the Central Nervous System. My name is Stephanie Weiss, and I'm Associate Professor of Radiation Oncology and Chief of the Neurologic Tumor Service at Fox Chase Cancer Center. I have no disclosures. The objectives of this talk will be to familiarize you with some of the new developments in treating brain tumors, to help support your decision making in the clinic with the literature, and to let you understand areas of controversy that are evolving surrounding the treatment of brain tumors. And we'll start off with high-grade glioma. Integrated diagnosis. Most high-grade gliomas present with headache, occasionally seizure or focal symptoms. Patients at increased risk include patients with Li-Fermani syndrome, Lynch syndrome, those who have a mismatch repair deficiency, and those who had prior exposure to radiation. There's a gliogene project going on nationally that is looking to identify families at risk. Neuroimaging is key. High-grade gliomas will typically enhance with contrast, typically rim enhancing with central necrosis, and will have increased T2 and flare signal. The EORTC performed the classic Stupp trial that demonstrated that the addition of temozolomide to radiotherapy offered a survival benefit for patients with GBM. The median survival only increased from about 15 to 18 months, but there was a significant 2- and 5-year benefit with the addition of temozolomide. A companion study to this piece also looked at how the enzyme MGMT correlated with outcomes. In normal cells, MGMT plays a role of removing alkyl groups from cells, which can be cancerogenic, therefore is an important enzyme in helping normal healthy tissue routinely combat against developing a cancer. However, temozolomide works through alkylization of tumor moieties. And the theory was that if there was active MGMT removing these alkyl groups, the temozolomide would not work as well. Thus, a silenced or methylated MGMT would be correlated with better results with temozolomide. And while indeed MGMT methylation was associated with better outcome, even patients whose tumors were unmethylated, as you can see on the right, did better with temozolomide. So temozolomide is given to typically all patients with GBM. Roger Stupp also looked at a novel therapy of alternating electric current or tumor treating fields, which demonstrated a survival benefit that was on the order of magnitude to what we saw with the addition of temozolomide to radiotherapy. And so tumor treating fields are now considered standard of care. Dermatitis on the scalp, which needs to be shaved to wear the pads to deliver the therapy, is the biggest side effect, along with more frequent incidence of depression in patients in the tumor treating field group. The major criticism of this study was patients receiving tumor treating fields were not blinded. In other words, there was no sham treatment. So perhaps their better outcome had to do with more aggressive healthcare in general, because they knew they were on the treatment arm of the study. So in terms of treatment planning, we typically will do the flare on T2 or sorry, Flare T2 image with a 1.5 centimeter expansion to CTV. And you take that in 2 gray to 46 gray. And you should be sure to include in this first course both the cavity as well as any enhancement on the T1 with contrast. Occasionally, these things are not associated with flare, and if you forget to look for that, you might exclude it from the first course and subsequently undertreat. You then cone down to the contrast enhancement and cavity to a sum of 60 gray, and you definitely want to respect the normal constraints. There's some published evidence that anti-angiogenic drugs such as bevacizumab, which are often given particularly at relapse for high-grade gliomas, is associated with a higher incidence of post-radiation neurogenic injury, particularly to the chiasm. So keeping hotspots off the chiasm and the optic nerves is important. The course of radiation is accompanied by temozolomide, 75 milligrams per meter square, as well as being followed after a month with temozolomide, 150 milligrams, 200 milligrams per meter square, with the Tumor Treating Fields. There's no routine role for bevacizumab, however, it can be helpful either at relapse or in the setting of persistent mass effect, patients stuck on steroids. It closes down the blood-brain barrier and often greatly will improve a patient symptomatically. That in turn can not only improve quality of life, but can perhaps provide a more concrete survival benefit to patients in that category. So the question moves then to how do we approach anaplastic gliomas, the conventional grade 3? Does chemotherapy matter? Does de novo and salvage treatment sequencing matter? And this question was first addressed by the German NOAA Group 04 about 10 years ago, and this encompassed all classic high-grade, rather anaplastic gliomas. And the CONSORT diagram here looks somewhat complicated, but it's fairly straightforward. What they were asking was two questions. The first, did patients do better if they received radiotherapy up front with chemotherapy at progression? Or did they do better with chemotherapy up front followed by radiotherapy at progression? The second question was, when they progressed with chemotherapy, when they had chemotherapy, was it better if they started off with PCV followed by temozolomide at progression, or the other way around, temozolomide with PCV at progression? So time to progression was a bit improved for patients who received radiation up front. This did not manifest out until about 3 to 4 years. And we saw that patients with the classic oligo subtype did better regardless. So, an interesting long-term analysis demonstrated a couple of important things. The first was it looked at patients with co-deletion. So, remember, these were all the anaplastic tumors, astrocytoma, oligo, and mixed. And they looked at the co-deleted tumors, which, as we spoke about, really are what we think of as the classic oligo nowadays. And we found with these tumors, remember they were sequenced to receive either PCV followed by temozolomide at progression or the other way around. And they found that progression-free survival was superior with PCV first. So PCV for co-deleted, quote-unquote, classic oligo subtype seemed to be a superior regimen. And this becomes important and is a thread we're going to see carry on. And the other thing is you'll notice they're circled in green that actually, in fact, patients did particularly well with progression-free survival with radiotherapy up front. So the importance of radiotherapy here shouldn't be missed. So remember, NOAA 04 looked at sequencing therapy at time of progressive disease. Both the RTOG and EORTC decided to look at the upfront addition of chemotherapy. The difference between these trials was that the RTOG did pre-radiation chemo. This, of course, was all though upfront. The radiation and the chemotherapy occurred after surgery. There was no delay until progression. And the EORTC looked at radiation followed by the chemotherapy. Again, all de novo. And there was unquestionably a survival benefit noticed in the RTOG trial that looked at PCV followed by radiotherapy compared to radiotherapy alone. And the overall survival favored the addition of PCV when adjusted for deletion. So again, this is the classic oligo subpopulation that that showed a survival benefit. Now, interestingly, there were patients who had non-deleted tumors in the RTOG trial who still benefited from the addition of PCV. So significantly more patients were living greater than 10 years after combined therapy versus radiotherapy alone. So who were these patients who did not have co-deleted or oligo-like tumors who were getting the benefit of chemotherapy? And the answer is it seemed to be patients with IDH mutated lesions. So these grade 3 tumors that were IDH mutated, whether or not they were co-deleted, seemed to get a substantial overall survival benefit from the addition of chemotherapy. And this was not seen with patients with wild-type tumors. Now, the patients who had co-deleted tumors on the left with the IDH mutation did particularly well. Patients on the right were those with the non-deleted or more astrocytoma-like tumors, but who did have the IDH mutation. And we saw generally similar results for patients in EORTC. Again, same general population, and you see a benefit in adding PCV to radiotherapy. The only difference in this trial, again, was it was radiotherapy followed by PCV, both, however, de novo. And when you looked at the patients who had the co-deletion, again, the oligo-like tumors, you see near significant overall survival benefit in adding PCV and less so for the non-deleted tumors, the more astrocytoma-like tumors. So in summary, the last few trials we've looked at, we're seeing a benefit of chemotherapy, particularly PCV chemotherapy, less so temozolomide for these oligo-like tumors. So again, you can appreciate now looking not just at the histopathology, but the IDH subtype and co-deletion subtype will give us better prognosis, probably better prediction to treatment at this point. Now, recent data has come out with the CATNON trial. So CATNON referring to the non-deleted, non-co-deleted anaplastic tumors. So this trial is designed to look at patients who get radiation alone, who get the STUP regimen, which is, again, both concomitant and adjuvant temozolomide, and also two other arms, radiation with just the concomitant temozolomide or just the adjuvant temozolomide. It was stratified by many of these prognostic factors and amended in 2011 to include IDH. So again, CATNON, non-deleted, these are the non-oligo-like or astrocytoma-like. And again, this is the STUP regimen, so we're not looking at PCV. Okay, so we're looking at astrocytoma using temozolomide as opposed to oligodendroglioma, co-deleted looking at PCV. And we're seeing a benefit to the progression-free and overall survival with the addition of adjuvant temozolomide in these non-deleted tumors. Recent update at ASCO 2019 looked at the concomitant temozolomide arm, and essentially there was no overall difference in for patients receiving the concomitant temozolomide arm. And remember, the last slide we looked at was adjuvant. Now, patients who had IDH mutated tumors, again, non-codeleted but IDH mutated, did get an overall benefit in survival compared to the wild type tumors. All right, so if you look at those patients with the mutated IDH who received adjuvant temozolomide, which for the last slide, we knew there was a benefit, okay, and you can see it there, a hazard ratio of 0.41. And then you look to see, did those patients get a benefit from concomitant temozolomide? We see that the hazard ratio is below one, but it hasn't reached significance. So this role of concomitant temozolomide is really still unresolved, and this is only in presentation form only. So this is certainly evolving data. In summary, the CATNON trial, this non-significant trend for concomitant temozolomide for mutated IDH tumors that are astrocytoma-like because they're non-deleted. Adjuvant temozolomide definitely demonstrated a benefit for these mutated IDH lesions, but not wild type. And again, this is temozolomide, and at this point, we're still generally recommending radiation temozolomide along the Stupp regimen, but it's a work in progress. So for the non-deleted tumors, we know that from CATNON, TMZ improves survival from EORTC and RTOG. PCV offers minimal benefit with the non-deleted astrocytoma-like tumors. So for the co-deleted, more oligo-like tumors that are chemosensitive, can radiation be delayed? And that's what the CODEL trial was seeking to examine. The most recent data is nearly 4 years old now. It randomized patients to radiation versus the Stupp regimen versus temozolomide alone, with overall survival as the primary endpoint. And essentially, the progression-free survival for these chemosensitive tumors was only 2.5 years, not yet reached with radiation. In fact, there were a number of progressive tumors while on TMZ, and 33% were dead from disease who were in the temozolomide alone arm versus 4% in the radiation alone arm. So the risk of death, the hazard ratio was much higher for temozolomide, and that arm, the temozolomide alone arm, closed down. Now, furthermore, remember, co-deleted, oligo-like, PCV is better. So recently, the arm that included radiation plus chemotherapy was changed to PCV based on RTOG EORTC. So moving to high-grade glioma in therapy in the elderly population, essentially the elderly population was excluded from most of these trials, ironically because that tends to be the population that is targeted by the disease. And in 2007, the French looked at treatment in the elderly population versus supportive care. So the thought was, how are we are we offering any benefit to these patients who have a particularly poor prognosis as age was correlated with a worse outcome, and how did it impact on quality of life? So patients were randomized to radiation therapy. It was a slightly lower dose than we tend to give in the United States, and chemotherapy was not included because this was published shortly after the first Stupp data. And it was randomized to supportive care, discontinued after the first interim analysis that showed significant overall survival benefit to the radiotherapy without severe adverse events, and quality of life and cognitive evaluations were not significantly different. So for patients who did want to who who did want to move forward with therapy, but were concerned about whether or not it was advantageous, how it would impact quality of life, and what that trade-off was. This was the first answer we had for them. And subsequently, there have been a few studies that have looked at various strategies to treat older patients with high-grade glioma. So NOAA 808 looked at temozolomide versus radiation for high-grade astrocytoma, which is what you typically will see in the elderly population, with the overall survival as the endpoint. And this was a non-inferiority study of the chemotherapy. So the goal wasn't to show that it was superior, just that it was not substantially clinically inferior. And based on the 0.03 non-inferiority criteria that was set, it was considered non-inferior to radiotherapy. Patients who had MGMT methylation did tend to do better. And it's actually worth looking at this trial if you are seriously considering putting somebody on temozolomide alone, because there's a nice table that shows you not only the prognostic factors, but the predictive factors. In other words, who might be more likely to benefit from temozolomide alone. So this is a Lancet article from 2012. Nevertheless, it's important to note this was not compared to chemo or radiation. This was an either-or regimen. And we typically don't have patients who choose chemotherapy alone. A New England Journal of Medicine paper that came out in 2017 actually evaluated the role of radiation with or without temozolomide. So excuse the typo at the head of the slide. This is patients who were receiving hypofractionated regimen, which was 267 sonograms a day for 15 fractions. And they were randomized to that versus that regimen plus Stupp chemotherapy. Again, no comparison with the standard chemo radiation arm from the Stupp protocol. And what they found was that hypofractionation, which in a prior study was shown to be comparable to conventional therapy in the older population alone, outcomes were improved with the addition of temozolomide to this regimen, and it was a well-tolerated one. Methylated MGMT was predictive of outcome when temozolomide was added to the radiation, and there was a clinical benefit to temozolomide, even for the unmethylated patients, although this did not meet significance. It may have just been underpowered for this. Again, there was no direct comparison to the Stupp trial. And a caveat offered by Skip Grossman from Johns Hopkins, who did observe, with all the caveats that come with comparing across studies, that remember, because the Perry New England Journal trial of hypofractionation plus or minus temozolomide did not compare to the Stupp regimen, we don't know if it is as good or non-inferior. And when you do look across studies, you can see the Stupp regimen, where patients received conventional radiotherapy and temozolomide, their curve is the top one on the left. They have superior outcomes, and the patients in the Perry trial are the ones with the diamonds, did not do as well. And so it may not be as robust as the Stupp regimen, so is often recommended just for patients who are more frail or whose prognosis is such that they're felt they want to put a premium on keeping time away from coming to the clinic. The non-inferiority or superiority of one of these regimens over the other is not answered. And finally, when you follow up your patients with high-grade glioma, the RANO criteria is key here. This is how you're going to follow them, and it's certainly more involved than what I have here, and it's worth looking at. But it's important to note that you have to be concerned about both pseudoprogression and pseudoresponse. So pseudoprogression is typically what you can see after either radiation alone or chemoradiation, more frequently with chemoradiation, when you obtain a scan within the first 12 weeks. So at that point, if you see any enhancement within the 80% isodose line, you cannot call that progression. That could be pseudoprogression, or just what we say is treatment effect, and should not prompt an investigation such as surgery or a change in therapy. Very often, in fact, the scan looks worse than the patient, who can often look very good. And it's really very helpful to remind a patient several times, certainly at their end of treatment summary, that this is a very common phenomenon, and getting a baseline scan about 4 weeks after radiotherapy is typically standard to assess things moving forward, but it very likely will look worse when, in fact, it's a sign of treatment efficacy. So you can only call progression if there's enhancement outside of the 80% isodose line within the first 12 weeks of chemoradiation. Otherwise, it is pseudoprogression. Pseudoresponse, on the other hand, is in patients something you see for patients receiving anti-angiogenic therapy. Typically, the drug, which shuts down the blood-brain barrier, will make enhancement look significantly improved and is often added as a therapy for that reason in patients who have residual mass effect after a subtotal resection. Their scan looks much better. And if you're looking at the old McDonald criteria, which measures the stability, diminution, or progression of T1 plus contrast findings, you may falsely consider that there's a response to therapy. Whereas if you are not ignoring the T2 or FLAIR imaging, you might at the same time notice an increase. And that is a sign, in fact, of the lesion is probably progressing, that there's no breakdown in the blood-brain barrier because of the bevacizumab or the anti-angiogenic agent. So the enhancement looks better, but meanwhile, there's progressive disease and hence some increasing signal on T2 FLAIR imaging, and that is pseudoresponse. So that is something to be cautious of. And now we'll move on to low-grade glioma. So low-grade gliomas represent about 15% of all primaries, accounting for about 2,000 cases a year in the United States. Frequently present with seizures. Lesions are not uncommonly in the temporal lobes, which is very epileptogenic. Seizures, in fact, are a favorable prognostic factor compared to other neurologic deficits, and that's an important factor to remember, and actually can be favorable compared to an abnormal exam. They're heterogeneous groups, so like high-grade gliomas, we are moving more towards molecular or an integrated classification. But classically, we thought about them in terms of diffuse astrocytoma, oligoastrocytoma, and oligodendroglioma, all grade 2, which had survival of 5 to 10 years when parsed out that way. Again, this is evolving target as we move to astrocytoma, however, you still need to know is GFAP positive with neuroglial fibrils. While oligodendrogliomas have the fried egg appearance with these perinuclear halos. Now, a key element to both boards and your clinic in terms of confirming the diagnosis has to do with imaging. For a low-grade glioma, you do not expect to see any enhancement on the T1 plus contrast scan. Any enhancement noted in the setting of a pathologic diagnosis of low-grade glioma raises a suspicion for sampling error, or less commonly, a pathologic diagnostic error. You do not expect to see enhancement for low-grade gliomas, grade 2. We are excluding from this the pilocytic astrocytoma grade 1, which typically is contrast enhancing, but is something we keep for the pediatric review. You do expect to see increased signal on flare, often a mass-like pattern, and calcifications are not uncommon and are suggestive of 1p19q deletion or oligodendro component. There's an important role for surgery, both in diagnosis, with again, caution with regard to the possibility of undersampling in lesions that cannot be totally resected. But there's also very probably a therapeutic benefit to surgery, though there are no randomized controlled trials evaluating the extent of resection. There is an MRI correlate study showing that completeness of resection is related to overall survival. And in the so-called Believers trial, which was a dose escalation trial of radiotherapy for low-grade glioma, if some radiation is good, more is better, was the thinking. There was an observed benefit to more extensive resection. Furthermore, RTOG 9802, which we'll discuss in some detail, looked at the extent of surgery. Patients who were considered low risk, in other words, they had a near total resection and were young, nevertheless had a much better outcome if they had less than a centimeter residual of disease. Even 1 centimeter of residual disease was associated with a worse outcome. So, in fractions of 1.8 gray, the thought that there may be less toxicity for these lesions or for these patients who have reasonably good prognosis. So there was a Believers trial, there was also the non-believers trial. Those who said that radiotherapy was not something that needed to be given up front in the de novo setting, it could be saved as salvage. So surgery alone was compared to patients with adjuvant radiotherapy, and the progression-free survival at 5 years was certainly superior with radiotherapy. However, the overall survival in the initial and long-term follow-up data showed that survival was comparable between the two arms, which didn't mean that radiation didn't work, it just meant it worked just as well at relapse. Of note, it did help to reduce seizures at 1 year out. So it is often delivered in patients who have refractory seizures from low-grade glioma. Because it's observed that some low-grade glioma patients don't do as well as others, the question's been raised, who is at high risk, and then what do we do to treat them? So RTOG 9802 was designed based on earlier trials that from the intergroup that looked at what seemed to be high and low risk factors and essentially stratified low-grade glioma patients to low risk if they both were young, less than 40, and had a gross total resection. And these patients were observed prospectively. High-risk patients were called patients who had a subtotal resection and/or were older than 40, and they were randomized to either 54 gray of radiation versus radiation followed by 6 cycles of PCV chemotherapy. So for the low-risk patients, it was observed that at 5 years, the overall survival was 93%, which was pretty good, and nevertheless, they were able to look at these low-risk patients to find out what other factors were associated with progression-free survival. So again, extent of resection was, as well as overall size of the tumor, up front. Pure oligodendroglioma also did better than patients who were astrocytoma or mixed histopathology, and the more favorable prognostic factors, the better in terms of outcome, showing that five-year progression-free survival could be 70% if they were all favorable versus 13% if they were all unfavorable, belying again the sometimes glioblastoma-like behavior of some of these so-called low-grade, low-risk lesions. The high-risk patients who were older and or had a subtotal resection, again, were randomized to radiotherapy versus radiotherapy plus PCV chemotherapy. So these patients receiving 54 gray were observed, and at the two-year analysis, there was no difference in overall survival, but a post-hoc analysis suggested that patients who lived more than 2 years had a survival benefit from the addition of chemotherapy with PCV. And this was confirmed at ASTRO 2014 by Manesh Mehta, who showed that the median overall survival with radiation therapy alone was 7.8 years, nearly double with chemotherapy on top of that to 13.3 years. 10-year survival was 40 versus 60 months. So again, the hazard ratio improved significantly from 0.72 to 0.59 with a little more maturation of this data. And it illustrates an important point. We see this here, we see this with meningioma, and we see this really with any tumor entity that has a propensity for late failure. Early results and actuarial results can underestimate the effect of therapy because the effect of therapy may not become clear until really many years down the road. In the 2019 ASCO update, no benefit of PCV was noted for patients with wild-type IDH. Again, these are the astrocytoma-like tumors who are not receiving a benefit from PCV. Not just only astrocytoma-like, they're more like the GBM-like tumors. PCV, however, did show a benefit to patients with mutated IDH, whether or not they were co-deleted or non-co-deleted. So in other words, whether or not they were oligo or astrocytoma-like. And this data, again, is still... So again, we define the American definition of high-risk low-grade glioma as being either age 40 or older and or having a less than a gross total resection. The Europeans have also analyzed their data, essentially the believers and the non-believers data, as a modeling and validation set, and found that there were five factors that were all associated with a worse outcome. Age, again, greater than 40 years or greater. Astrocytoma histology, a largest diameter of lesion of 6 centimeters or greater. Tumor crossing midline, and the presence of neurologic deficits, not, however, including seizure, which, as you remember, is more of a favorable prognostic factor either, because it brings attention to the tumor sooner when it's smaller, or because it's in a site that can be gross totally resected. So three of these variables in the European definition is considered high risk. Now, when you try and come up with a Venn diagram, looking at the various ways you can come up with a high-risk patient in the EORTC definition, and then compare it to the U.S. definition, which is, again, increasing age and less than total resection, you'll actually see there are probably very few ways you can combine the European risk factors so that they don't actually look very similar to the American risk factors. And what I mean by that is, if you have a large tumor greater than 6 centimeters, certainly a tumor crossing midline, you're probably starting to talk about a lesion that is not going to be gross totally resected. So, in fact, while this seems much more granular, it probably is really clinically coming very close to what you see in terms of high risk in the American sense as well. You can imagine perhaps an astrocytoma histology, a large 6 centimeter lesion that actually can be resected and presenting with a neurologic deficit, perhaps meeting the European definition of high risk, but not the American definition. But that instance is probably fairly uncommon. RTOG-0424 actually looked at patients with this European definition of high risk and compared it to historic controls. So it was a phase two trial. Patients given 54 gray with temozolomide. So this time temozolomide, not PCV, concurrently and then followed by 12 cycles. So similar to the Stupp regimen, but lower dose of radiation and 12 rather than 6 cycles of chemotherapy. And it was, they set a high bar to, in this single arm analysis, to call any comparison to this historical control significant. It was designed to detect a 43% increase in median survival time and a 20% improvement in 3-year overall survival time. So the historical survival time was 40.5 months, and they needed to see patients surviving more than 58 months in order to call this significant. And in fact, they detected an improved 3-year overall survival benefit to 65 months. So they did say that this was a successful trial. But again, not randomized. Used the European definition and looked at temozolomide. The thinking at the time is temozolomide is much easier to tolerate than PCV. But of course, as we've seen, there's increasing suggestion that oligo-like does better with PCV, whereas astro-like does better with temozolomide. Gorlia et al., at your leisure, worth looking at. They've tried to combine these data sets and look them at them together to come up with a prognostic model and a calculator for low-grade glioma that you could look for online. It's the EORTC LGG calculator, low-grade glioma calculator, if you want to use for your own patients. If you have concerns about perhaps subjecting someone to undertreatment by switching an oligo to temozolomide rather than PCV, or the toxicity of PCV in a more frail student, frail patient, for instance. In terms of biomarkers, we don't have any mature data on this, and EORTC 22033 is still maturing. So today, as of 2020, treatment planning for low-grade gliomas typically will include the postoperative cavity plus flare T2 weighted imaging with the GTV plus about a 2 centimeter margin to PTV. Again, there's some variation about the theme. Doses going from 50.4 to 54 gray in 180 sonogray fractions with respect to the chiasm globes, the retina, and keeping hot spots off of the brain stem. There are a lot of controversies now since these last few chemotherapy studies have come out that have divided things from high to low risk. For instance, if a tumor is initially low risk, what happens at recurrence? Do you resect it again? If a patient is, let's say, less than 40 and has a repeat gross total resection, are they still low risk? And do you resort to that paradigm again? If the patient is now over 40 and doesn't or does not get a gross total resection, should they now be treated as high risk? And what kind of dose do you use for high risk? So these controversies will probably take another long time to resolve, again, because of the slow-growing nature of these lesions. Moving on to brain metastases. Going to approach this a little differently. We're going to take into account a lot of clinical pearls, although I'll be sure to include the relevant literature that you're going to need to know, particularly for boards. So brain metastases occur in about 30% of all cancer patients and probably are increasing with improved systemic therapy. There are about 175,000 new cases a year, most of which are lung cancer, followed by breast, particularly HER2 new positive cancers, unknown primary melanoma, colon, and rectum. And with best supportive care, survival has historically been only a couple of months, although nowadays, with better screening and better systemic therapies, is probably they're probably doing even better. So we look to the site-specific GPA in order to prognosticate for our patients. Sperduto et al. Has come up with GPAs for various different types. This, for instance, is breast cancer. So if we have a patient with a KPS of 100, a tumor subtype of luminal B or triple positive, and age less than 60, adding up the points they get for each domain, gives them a score of 4. So group 4, as you can see here, has a median survival time of 25 months with a 3-year overall survival of 31%. So this is certainly much better than the old estimate of approximately 6 months survival seen for patients with brain mets. Similarly, you can see for lung cancer, the factors that go into the GPA scoring include the patient's age, KPS, status, presence or absence of extracranial disease, the number of brain metastases, and importantly, the gene status, ALK negative or unknown, EGFR negative or unknown versus positive. And there's similar ones for melanoma, renal, and GI cancer. These will help stratify how you might want to approach these patients. In terms of how you should think about them when they come through your door, a good way to start is to consider whether or not they're asymptomatic. If they're asymptomatic and essentially you have an imaging finding, patient for screening was found to have some lesions that were noted or just incidentally found somehow, you can essentially look at them and say if there's minimal or even moderate edema and they're asymptomatic, you don't necessarily need to put them on steroids. If certainly there's a large amount of vasogenic edema and it's making you nervous, which certainly the definition of that can vary person to person, and all any of us can do is treat based on how we feel comfortable. If you see that, you can place them on steroids. However, there's no routine role for antiepileptics unless a patient has presented with a seizure. So if a patient comes to you even with a impressive looking scan, it's felt by the Association of Neurology that the antiepileptics are probably in that situation more toxic than they are advantageous. Now, if the patient comes in your door symptomatic, typically it's going to patient's going to present with headaches. The classic pattern is new onset, or if they're, let's say, migraineurs, a new pattern of headache, often with associated symptoms such as nausea. These tend to be worse in the morning or when they're laying flat. They're dependent. So once they sit upright, gravity pulls fluid down, they feel better. A lot of times they will say, well, I'll eat breakfast or take a Tylenol and then feel better. And it's really more that just gravity had a chance to do its thing. Headaches will typically be increasing in frequency over time. And if a patient describes a sudden severe headache, particularly after you know they have metastases and is, let's say, under treatment, you want to be cautious of hemorrhage. So the lesions that you really should be suspicious of hemorrhage for are renal cell and melanoma. We don't see them often, but thyroid cancer and choriocarcinoma also have a propensity for this. Now, having said that, just if you were to count the absolute number of lesions that have hemorrhaged, most of them will be lung cases simply because that is the most common tumor. So, a low threshold of suspicion for renal melanoma, but keep in mind lung particularly as well. Any histology can hemorrhage, however. In terms of managing them, if a patient has profound symptoms, you can load them with a 10 milligram Decadron load. The bioavailability orally is actually pretty good, but frequently people in this scenario will give them IV push, followed by 4 milligrams, either QID or 8 milligrams BID. However, you'll find for most patients, you don't need these kinds of, heavy doses of steroids, and 4 to 8 milligrams a day will be sufficient. So again, a lot of this has to do with your comfort level, and you essentially want to titrate down the patient as they are tolerated, and never forget to give them GI prophylaxis. PPIs are necessary typically, as standard doses of H2 blockers are not often effective. Now, you very frequently will improve their quality of life with these because GERD is common, but you may even save a life. It doesn't happen often, but it does happen that patient will develop an ulcer on steroids that can be prevented and can even bleed out. So all these patients on PPI. You might want to screen for elevated glucose if they're diabetic. Certainly, that should be on your radar. If a person has glucose up to 250 while on steroids, while they're being treated, not normally on insulin, I don't worry about it too much, but you do keep an eye on these things. If they go up much higher or certainly are labile, you really want to bring in the PCP to help you manage that. Patients on steroids for greater than 4 to 6 weeks should be put on PJP, used to be known as PCP prophylaxis. Typically, that's Bactrim double strength TIW. If they have a sulfa allergy, you can consider etovaquone or pentamidine. And it's very often you will see the problem as you're tapering off steroids. Patients have PCP or PJP, and part of what you do to treat their respiratory distress is put them on steroids, but you've also immunosuppressed them. So you come down off the steroids that you immunosuppress them with, the PJP has a chance to present itself, and then you have a patient in respiratory distress. Avoidable with these drugs. Plus, the steroid myopathy is something to be cautious of. Some patients really demonstrate a profound steroid myopathy. They're the ones who typically will have the moon facies, but what you'll see is proximal muscle weakness. Another reason you want to taper these guys off steroids really as soon as you reasonably can. Steroid myopathy can confound interpretation of edema-related symptoms. A patient might have weakness, which you can't distinguish from weakness pertaining to the lesion. And you can consider converting to dose equivalent prednisone. That could help them out somewhat. As you taper steroids, just be mindful if a patient complains of myalgias, arthralgias, headache, lethargy, that could be steroid withdrawal syndrome. And then you can just raise the dose a bit and taper a little more slowly. Adrenal insufficiency is something to be critically aware of. These are patients who are on steroids for a while. Their adrenals don't quite kick back in, and they need to be considered for replacement of basal steroid requirement, which is typically hydrocortisone, and patients should see endocrine for a consult to do this. You'll typically be alerted to the problem when the patient gets down to the equivalent of adrenal dosing, like 2 milligrams or lower than 2 milligrams a day of Decadron, and you're having a hard time tapering them off from that. They get fatigued, overall just not doing well, and that's an indication that they have adrenal insufficiency. All these patients should be educated about the need for stress doses of steroid. If they get the flu or so, need a surgery, they may need increased steroid. That's why you want endocrine to be involved with them. For a patient who does have known seizures, it's good to give them a prescription, unless otherwise contraindicated, for Ativan. If they have a pre-seizure aura, they can dissolve 0.5 milligram to 1 milligram sublingually, and that will usually break the event, give them a chance to call neurology or go to the emergency room. In terms of other indications for prophylactic anti-epileptic drugs, typically Keppra 500 POBID, that's the levetiracetam again, will be given for the postoperative setting with a gradual taper 1 to 2 weeks afterwards. Some people do this for SRS. National study has indicated that really there's no consistent practice. But again, no standard role for AEDs in absence of seizures. So let's move on to patients who have extensive disease, such as carcinomatosis or leptomeningeal spread. These things are often used simultaneously. Scott Soltis and Brandon Turner recently did some work trying to standardize the nomenclature where classic leptomeningeal disease is the pattern you're seeing here, which I tend to call carcinomatosis. You've got disease in the cerebral spinal fluid that just settles in and coats in the brain. Nodular leptomeningeal disease, he refers to as what you see when they're spread in the dura, but localized to, for instance, a resection cavity. For the sake of the discussion here, I'm going to refer to carcinomatosis as this more diffuse pattern where you've got disease circulating in the cerebral spinal fluid, which may or may not show up on an MRI, versus dural spread. So this is a classic picture of so-called carcinomatosis. You see this sugar coating formation along the cerebellum in the folia. You can see it also up higher in the supratentorial region in the right parietal lobe, although it's less commonly seen in that area. You should always look carefully for cranial nerve involvement. Cranial nerve 8 or 5 is what you'll often see. That suggests leptomeningeal carcinomatosis. Conceptually distinct from that is dural disease, or sometimes pachymeningeal disease. So in this instance, we're less worried about circulating tumor cells in the CSF than we are about just disease in or around the dura. And if it's around the dura in this sort of thick rind that surrounds a good portion of the brain, it's called pachymeningeal disease. And conceptually, I think it's different because the way I want to approach it's different. Dural disease that's not causing any symptoms and not rapidly changing really doesn't need any active treatment any more than, let's say, a lesion in the calvarium that is not eroding through and is asymptomatic would. If there is dural disease that is compressing a local region of the brain, you might treat that local spot with, for instance, radiosurgery. This is opposed to carcinomatosis, where really anything bathed in the CSF is at risk. Keep in mind, radiologists and other physicians often use the term leptomeningeal disease interchangeably with carcinomatosis, so you really want to ask them what they're seeing. Carcinomatosis is diagnosed in about 5% of patients, although is probably present more like 20% of patients. And a key feature is that the symptoms that a patient has may not focally correlate with their MRI. Steroids may or may not relieve the symptoms. And it's estimated that carcinomatosis will only show up in an MRI about 50% of the time. So a person with a high clinical suspicion without an MR correlate should still be considered for further workup. Workup can include an LP, but keep in mind, a positive LP will only occur about 50% of the time with a single lumbar puncture. You need, in order to call an LP truly negative, three negative LPs. So if you do an LP and the first time you get positive for cells, you know that's real. But if it's negative, there's still, in the setting of true carcinomatosis, 50% chance that there's still disease there. So the question to ask yourself is, are you going to get an LP because it's going to change your clinical management? In other words, a patient with clinical suspicion and a negative MRI might be a good patient to send for an LP. A patient who is already going to get whole brain for some reason, or a patient who has imaging findings very consistent with carcinomatosis, like that sugar coating, really does not need to get an LP. High protein, lymphocytic pleocytosis, and low glucose are suggestive of carcinomatosis, but again, not pathognomonic. If you do make a diagnosis of carcinomatosis, this is an indication for a full axis MRI sooner rather than later. Disease can be anywhere along the CSF, and you might want to consider treating any bulky disease with radiotherapy. When you examine a patient with carcinomatosis, you're going to tend to find dysfunction beyond the patient's symptoms. Headaches are going to occur in about half of these patients and can be associated with increased pressure and hydrocephalus. So, a patient who has progressive headaches, certainly with nausea and vomiting, should be reassessed as soon as you can with a CT for developing hydrocephalus, with a question to the radiologist to assess that specifically. Patient can get marked relief with a VP shunt, and some patients can do quite well afterwards with continued radiotherapy, particularly if they've got responsive disease. So don't necessarily think of this as a Delphian event that heralds an absolute poor prognosis. You can intervene and potentially give a patient months to years of survival. Headaches also can be caused just from meningeal irritation and be improved over time with treatment. Cranial neuropathies are common. Seizures and altered mental status can occur. And again, pay attention to spinal symptoms. Remember, MRI is only positive 50% of the time where carcinomatosis exists. And be very careful if you send a patient for an MRI after an LP. It risks a false positive, low pressure causing more prominent enhancement of the vessels, looking like sugar coating consistent with disease. So be mindful of the timing of your procedures in terms of imaging and any LP. Again, be alert for hydrocephalus, nausea, vomiting, and headaches that require urgent neurosurgical consult and shunt. Some shunts can be reversible. A VP shunt is a permanent place shunt. There is some concern for risk of seeding of the peritoneum. It's actually not as common as you might think, although certainly can occur. And keep in mind, the risk for leptomeningeal carcinomatosis is increased in patients who have had resection, particularly a piecemeal resection of tumor, who have tumor that was touching the dura, and who have breast cancer, particularly in the posterior fossa, whether or not they have a resection. So the standard for patients with more than 10 metastases is whole brain. We'll come back to that in a little while. Patients with 5 to 10 lesions, again, patients who you do not think have carcinomatosis, may be good candidates for radiosurgery. There's a 23 institution prospective observational study from Japan that did an interesting analysis asking the question, are the results for patients who receive radiosurgery for up to 10 lesions, for 5 to 10 lesions, inferior statistically to those patients who have 2 to 4 lesions? And the overall primary outcome was overall survival, with various other secondary endpoints that we typically evaluate for patients with brain metastases. And what made this study interesting is they worked from the premise that We know that patients with single lesions have better survival than patients with 2 to 4 lesions, and we'll delve into that in a little while. So the question is, if we compare outcomes for patients who have radiosurgery for one lesion to those with 2 to 4, and compare those to patients with 5 to 10 tumors, what are we going to see in terms of overall survival? And the fact that they included patients with one lesion performs sort of an internal validation because, again, we expect that patients with one lesion to have a better overall survival than patients with 2 to 4 lesions after radiosurgery or, in fact, any form of so-called ablative therapy. And we see that here. And then we see the survival curve for patients with 5 to 10 lesions laying almost superimposed over the curve for patients with 2 to 4 lesions, suggesting their outcomes were equally good. So again, this was a non-inferior study. Patients who received radiosurgery did equally well in the long term in terms of overall survival, if they had 5 to 10 lesions compared to 2 to 4. And the cause of death for patients overall was extracranially 92% of the time, which is what we would hope to see given most of the cases of patients with oligometastatic disease do not die from intracranial progression. It was also observed that the volume of lesions was associated with survival, more so, obviously, than the number of lesions. It's worth noting that leptomeningeal disease was comparable between arms up to 12 months. However, more common for patients with more than 5 or 5 lesions compared to oligometastatic cases later down the road. The adverse events from radiosurgery was about 9% in both groups, suggesting at least when similar measures were used to observe for radionecrosis, it was no different based on the number of lesions. So there is good phase two data that is prospective and suggests that radiosurgery is reasonable for patients with up to 10 lesions. For patients with oligometastatic disease, that is 1 to 4 lesions, we have 4 randomized trials that note that adding whole brain to radiosurgery will improve local and regional brain control, but this will not routinely translate to an overall survival benefit. It will, however, add significant neurocognitive toxicity, and thus radiosurgery alone is favored for patients with oligometastatic disease. The first trial that we observed this in was a Japanese study in 2006, where patients had improved local and regional control with whole brain, but no survival benefit. Patients who received whole brain more frequently had deterioration of neurologic function due to the whole brain, and patients who had radiosurgery only also had some neurologic decline due to the progressive disease. A widely cited but somewhat problematic study out of MD Anderson looked at a similar population of patients. And it was an interesting study because it looked at neurocognitive function for patients receiving SRS plus or minus whole brain radiotherapy and found that when neurocognitive status at 4 months post-therapy was the endpoint, neurocognitive function was certainly worse in the overall in the whole brain radiation group, as was overall survival. There are a lot of criticisms to this otherwise interesting study, namely the arms were poorly balanced in terms of many prognostic domains, and the use of 4 months as a time point to measure neurocognitive outcome is problematic based on results out of the same center in other places. For instance, in trials of neurocognitive function after brain RT, including in PCI trials where there was no competing risk of tumor, we see that radiation seems to cause a downtick in neurocognitive function that picks up again after about 4 months. Then there's a second downtick again after about a year. So it's a biphasic fluctuation. So measuring neurocognitive outcome at 4 months is somewhat problematic if that is going if neurocognitive outcome is your endpoint of interest, particularly for patients who are going to have a long-term survival. Now, the EORTC did a nice study looking at the same question, except in this case, patients received either neurosurgery or radiosurgery, followed either plus or minus our whole brain radiation. And essentially, patients who received surgery alone did very poorly. They had relapse greater than 50% of the time. Patients who had radiotherapy less frequently had relapse after surgery. Patients who had radiosurgery alone, however, did quite well, whether or not they had whole brain, although whole brain did reduce the risk of relapse both at the treatment site and in, as you can see on the right, any new progressive lesions in the brain. The Alliance trial, again, same question, radiosurgery plus or minus whole brain. And they essentially were looking at cognitive decline in one or more domains at 3 months as their endpoint. Again, the caveats looking at cognitive decline at that 3 month time point stand. However, what they found was that radiosurgery alone was superior in terms of cognitive function and quality of life. Their arms between those who received whole brain and those who didn't were better balanced than the MD Anderson trial. And they found no difference in functional independence or overall survival between the two groups. Again, no difference in overall survival with the receipt of whole brain radiation. And so we say for patients based on these studies with four or fewer lesions, radiosurgery is the standard of care. Whole brain is less favored because of the cognitive changes that occur afterwards, even though there is added protection against relapse at the treated site and at other sites in the brain. It's worth referencing a slightly earlier trial, RTOG 9508. Back in the day when whole brain was standard of care, this trial actually stratified patients to who had three or fewer mets to either receive or not receive a radiosurgical boost. So patients who had whole brain radiation therapy and three or fewer mets received an overall survival benefit if they had one lesion, if they got a radiosurgical boost. There was, however, no survival benefit if there were more lesions. But importantly, local control was superior with a radiosurgical boost. So if you have patients who, for whatever reason, perhaps they went for surgery and were at high risk of carcinomatosis, and then had whole brain radiation, if they are oligometastatic, they should routinely be considered for a radiosurgical boost. It's also worth noting when you are working with neurosurgical colleagues that they were looked at the difference in outcomes by treatment unit, in other words, Gamma Knife versus LINAC, and you couldn't have two curves better superimposed if you tried. So, treating a single brain met. We typically will recommend surgery when a patient is either remaining symptomatic on steroids, when you require pathology to confirm what you're treating, in other words, if it's going to change management, if primary radiotherapy is not technically feasible or safe. In these cases, surgery is the gold standard. Outside of this scenario, however, the question becomes, radiosurgery or surgery for a single brain met. So, first we turn our attention to definition. Single brain met will refer to a situation where there is no other brain lesion. However, you may have a patient with metastases elsewhere, whereas a solitary metastasis refers to a patient who has no other known metastases. Roy Patchell's classic trial, 1990, New England Journal of Medicine, looked at patients who had a presumed single brain met, and those patients were randomized to either a biopsy or resection. So pathologic tissue was available for all. And it was found that local recurrence, overall survival, time to recurrence of the index lesion, and the performance status, staying above 70, were all significantly favored in patients who underwent a full resection for the lesion. Now, a key point to keep in mind here, and something you're going to probably have to remind your medical and surgical colleagues, is that the Patchell study demonstrated the superiority of surgery compared to whole brain radiation alone for single metastases. In other words, not compared to radiosurgery alone. So this is very important. Patients may not routinely need surgery just because they have a single lesion, unless there's a question of documenting new metastatic disease, a question about the pathology, or persistently symptomatic lesions after steroids are added, or other situations where radiation is unsafe. Other important points from this and other surgical papers: death, again, primarily due to progressive intracranial disease. We frequently can control intracranial disease, 10 to 20% of death in patients with known metastatic disease of the brain occurs from the brain disease. And so it's worth treating these aggressively. There's also a likely higher risk of carcinomatosis for patients, again, who have piecemeal dissection, location of disease at the dura, breast cancer, and a posterior fossa lesion, whether or not there's resection. Finally, another key feature, and again, the thing that makes us want to be very thoughtful about findings on these scans, is that 11% of the patients in the Patchell trial were found to have an unexpected pathology at surgery. Remember, every patient had at very least a biopsy if they weren't randomized to resection. So there was pathology for all of them. So in the setting of a single lesion, we assume that up to 10% can be something other than expected. It may be lower nowadays because imaging is better, but it is. I've certainly seen several cases, for instance, of patients who were called as having metastatic disease presenting with a stroke or morantic endocarditis. I've also seen patients who had primary lesions that masquerade as metastatic diseases in patients with known cancers. So it's certainly worth keeping this in mind. So what is superior in terms of approaching a patient with a single brain met, surgery or radiosurgery? The highest quality data we have for this is a exploratory analysis of the EORTC study, where patients with metastatic disease of the brain received either surgery or radiosurgery, plus or minus whole brain alone. And this study was reanalyzed to compare outcomes based on surgery versus radiosurgery and stratified by receipt of whole brain radiation therapy. And if you look at the curves on the left, you'll see that resection without whole brain radiation therapy was associated with a cumulative recurrence of nearly 60% over time. Radiosurgery without whole brain radiation had a cumulative incidence of nearing 40% at the same period, again, about 5 years out. You start to see the curves plateau at about 3 years and stay reasonably stable after that. Patients who had a surgical resection followed by whole brain did much better, much more comparable to patients who had radiosurgery who had whole brain, the group that did the best. I think the most useful way of looking at this data is as a variate with time, covariate with time. Essentially, there was no superiority of one modality over the other. However, early on, radiosurgery, again stratified by receipt of whole brain radiation, seemed to be significantly superior to surgery. That superiority kind of tapered off so that as you got more than 9 months out, you were seeing more relapses in the radiosurgery arm than you did in the surgery arm. However, the absolute benefit still at that point was favoring radiosurgery. The interpretation here is that after surgery, if there's any residual disease, you're going to see that relapse fairly soon. Whereas if you're getting 9 months down the road and you haven't had relapse in the surgery arm, all the disease is probably gone or killed off. Whereas with radiosurgery, what we're probably seeing is generally robust control, however, perhaps not absolute or total cell kill, which allows some cells to escape over time. And the incidence of progression is more likely to be observed after 9 months in the radiosurgery arm. So Patchell turned his original question around: what happens if all patients have resection of a single lesion and then get postoperative whole brain radiation? Whole brain radiation essentially protected patients from a CNS death after resection. However, there was no overall survival or functional independence benefit in receiving whole brain. It did reduce, however, the incidence of other new lesions in the brain and local recurrence, just not translating this into a survival or independent function benefit. And so this brings us to the question of, in the modern era, what do we do in patients who do receive surgery for whatever reason? We know that they don't do well without some form of radiation, but we also know whole brain radiation is complicated by the neurocognitive sequelae of treatment. So Brown et al. Looked at postoperative SRS versus postoperative whole brain radiation with intact lesions treated with radiosurgery in that trial, with co-primary endpoints of overall survival and cognitive deterioration-free survival. And what they observed was the medium cognitive deterioration-free survival with SRS was superior to whole brain radiation. Now, the median outcome was only 3.7 months for the SRS arm and 3 months for the whole brain arm. So while there was a benefit, it really wasn't as profound as we would have liked to have seen. However, if you look at the curves, you will see down the line, they do separate. And so this certainly has led us to seriously consider postoperative SRS for these patients. There was no difference in overall survival. Now, in the supplementary data, there were some interesting outcomes with regard to control of the cavity after whole brain versus radiosurgery. After whole brain, control was 80% at 12 months, but only 60% after radiosurgery to the cavity. Now, compare this to the data we've looked at previously that evaluated radiosurgery plus or minus whole brain. We typically see about 70% control at 2 years with radiosurgery alone. With radiosurgery and whole brain, up to 80%. So, this control rate of 60% after surgery and radiosurgery of the cavity is really remarkably low. The reasons for this are being investigated. And one of the questions that has come on the table is the potential role in the future of preoperative radiosurgery, but this goes beyond our scope at this point. Of note, the incidence of carcinomatosis was comparable between the postoperative SRS and whole brain group, which was a little surprising. There was improvement in physical well-being amongst patients in the SRS to the cavity group. And the duration of functional independence was longer after SRS and not reached than in the whole brain group, which was 14 months. Amongst 12-month survivors, cognitive deterioration was noted to be about 37% at 3 months in the SRS group compared to 89% in the whole brain group. Over the subsequent 6, 9, and 12-month intervals, these numbers went up and down a little bit, but by 12 months, cognitive deterioration was 60% in the SRS group, 91% in the whole brain group. And this is in spite of better local and distant control from whole brain radiation. Following up after SRS, usually I'll follow 4 to 6 weeks just to make sure we weren't just looking at the tip of the iceberg, that there's nothing else brewing. We move that to 2 to 3 months, maybe 4 months, and extend maybe to every 6 months after a year. Bearing in mind, if there's any further relapse in the brain, we will shorten that interval. Certainly, we'll also consider that if the patient has been on systemic therapy and they discontinue it, it may have been holding things at bay or preventing a new showering or seeding in the brain. Certainly, if there's new disease, extracranial disease, particularly in the lung, I'll shorten the interval, as often that is a prelude to further CNS disease. Then, following up, I think our biggest challenge becomes distinguishing relapse from radionecrosis. It's estimated that there's radionecrosis up to a quarter of the patients, with symptomatic radionecrosis, if a patient lives long enough, 15 to 20%, if you're doing single fraction SRS. These numbers are really all over the place. There's no consistent definition of radionecrosis, as most lesions are not resected, and very few of these studies look at this prospectively in a robust way. Radionecrosis is felt to be associated with the size of the lesion, the location, whether or not you're treating over white matter, perhaps with the number of lesions or the volume receiving 10 to 12 gray, the use of systemic therapies, the biology of the tumor, and perhaps some host factors. It's extremely difficult and humbling trying to distinguish radionecrosis from progression. We found that dual-phase PET is useful. Essentially, the PET scan is done with a dedicated brain PET at two time points. And if you see over the second time point increased avidity, that is more concerning for progressive disease than radionecrosis. Perfusion imaging is another modality where you measure the relative cerebral blood volume in the lesion. And it includes the vascular transit time, the CBV, and the cerebral blood flow. So tumors have a higher relative cerebral blood volume and necrosis lower. And often dual phase PET and perfusion imaging are supplementary to each other. Now, necrosis typically presents as this feathery or mottled Swiss cheese pattern, with the patient having an MRI that's really out of proportion to their symptoms. They often look quite well. And a lot of times these will stabilize on MR, but not necessarily. You could have a recruiting necrosis. All I can really advise you is to be extremely humble in trying to follow these up. It's very difficult to determine what you're actually looking at. When you want to approach radionecrosis, there's actually randomized data in support of bevacizumab. So we typically will start with a steroid taper if symptomatic and repeat an MRI maybe 4 to 6 weeks. Surgery, of course, is diagnostic and therapeutic, and there's some more modern surgical therapies, for instance, such as LIT therapy, which essentially is thermal interstitial catheter threading to the lesion, which is heated up and will destroy the lesion. you don't get a diagnosis, but it is therapeutic. The trick usually is getting the insurance companies to pay for it. As I mentioned, bevacizumab can work. There's a randomized trial where 100% of patients receiving bevacizumab had a clinical and radiographic response versus those receiving placebo. Bevacizumab, of course, has other toxicities. It can increase blood pressure, cause kidney damage. There's increased risk of bleeding dyscrasias and perforated abdomen, so it comes with caution. Off-label, I have used COX-2 inhibitors with great success. So if a patient does not have a sulfa allergy and has good renal function, you might consider 100 milligrams POBID to 200 milligrams POBID. With COX-2 inhibitors, we typically caution patients there's a greater risk of cardiovascular incident if taken at a high dose for more than 6 months, but this is true for all NSAIDs. It can actually be very helpful, however, and again, relatively low risk of bleeding. Finally, patients who have a requirement for whole brain radiation, such as more than 10 lesions or are having multiple courses of immense amount of radiosurgery, may be eligible for hippocampal avoiding whole brain radiation. This was a phase 3 trial by Gandhi et al., looking at non-radiosensitive, i.e., non-lymphoma, non-small cell, non-germ cell lesions, patients who do not have leptomeningeal disease, randomizing whole brain with memantine to plus or minus hippocampal avoidance. And the hazard ratio for neurocognitive function decline was in favor of the hippocampal avoiding arm. There's a lower risk for executive function at 4 months, a lower risk for encoding and consolidation at 6 months, and patient-reported fatigue, difficulty with speaking, memory, all these things were improved at 6 months for patients receiving hippocampal avoidance. There's no difference in toxicity, overall survival, and CNS progression. This was presented most recently at ASCO 2019. A few more clinical pearls. Normal pressure hydrocephalus is something to keep an eye out for. Even with hippocampal avoidance, while you are sparing the neural stem cell niches, there are other mechanisms of neurocognitive decline that come with whole brain radiation. Certainly, you can have leukoencephalopathy, as you see on the left here, but also note that you can have over time dilated ventricles. Now, the important thing is to compare your MRI that is most recent to your initial MRI, not the most prior MRI. You'll see this periventricular T2 signal change that you could see there in the posterior horns. That's related to retrograde CSF flow. It's often useful to compare the third ventricle because very subtle differences in millimeters can really indicate some dilatation. But be mindful that you can have normal pressure hydrocephalus in a patient who really does not have much of a radiographic change. What you're looking for with MPH is the weird wet and wobbly. So the patient has the wobbly or magnetic gait. It looks like they're not quite picking their feet up when they walk. They'll talk about urinary urgency to incontinence and short-term memory and multitasking deficits, sometimes confusion. Again, you might see subtle changes on a pre-RT and a most recent post-RT at the third ventricle. And there's a nice little video you can see at lifenph.com, and you can show your patients. And the reason it's useful to know this is patients can be sent to a surgeon for considered for what's called an extended lumbar drain. So they take out usually over a period of a couple days some CSF. Patient is measured by physical therapy before and after, and often they will report an improvement in cognition and gait most frequently. This gives you a diagnosis of NPH and suggests you have about an 80% chance of improvement with a permanent VP shunt. So again, if you look at lifenph.com, you can see the difference that intervention can make. And for patients with a good survival, it definitely can affect quality of life. This, of course, is the classic whole brain radiation port. You kind of rough and ready way to do this is you find the frontal sinus and you start there splitting the frontal sinus, going along the base of the skull down to the mastoid process. And keep in mind, you want to get the little marker on the cribriform plate and the temporal lobes. And so moving on finally to our last section of meningioma. This is a putatively benign tumor. However, as you'll see, actually has great impact both on quality of life, including overall survival for patients. And historically, we've known since 1957, Simpson et al. Published their outcomes based on the extent of resection of the tumor. A grade 5 resection was merely a decompression or biopsy. Partial resection grade 4, grade 3 included a gross tumor resection. However, the attachment to the dura was left unmanipulated. If the attachment to the dura was coagulated, this was a grade 2. If it was actually removed along with any abnormal bone, this is grade 1. And the Kinjo et al. Defined the grade 0 resection, which is gross total removal of the tumor along with stripping of the dura. And essentially, the more extensive the resection from grade 5 down to grade 0, the better the control rate over time. Histopathologically, it's often overlooked that meningiomas very rarely are just one mass lesion. Borovitch et al. Looked at a series of cases, all of which were sporadic low-grade lesions, and all of them demonstrated islets distinct from the index lesion. About 64% demonstrated macroscopic islets up to 3 centimeters away, and there were microscopic islets in more than half. This would explain certainly why a more extensive resection with dural stripping improves outcome. Another interesting series comes from the Karolinska group in Sweden. Thanks to their national database, they had 25-year follow-up of patients and were able to record events for all of them. And what they found was fascinating, that even patients with excellent surgeries, namely grade 1 to 2 resections, so remember, not only taking out the lesion, but either taking out the attachment to the dura, the root as it were, or coagulating it, even these patients had a fairly high recurrence rate down the line, 13% at 10 years, but nearly 40% at 25 years. So keep in mind, these are the patients often sent to us as cured, these lesions that are low grade and you know, have had excellent surgery. And in fact, on this Karolinska database, these late failures were dominated by low-grade lesions with a low proliferative index. So remember what we said before about low-grade gliomas, that actuarial data is very, very risky when you're looking at tumors with a propensity for late failure. They tend to underestimate these. The morbidity and mortality rates at 25 years also is really far worse than I think is advertised by a lot of physicians. About 42% of patients after a gross resection, meaning resection of the lesion, regardless of whether or not the dura was coagulated or not, or taken out or not, they relapsed by 25 years, 42% of the time. 33% of patients with a gross total resection actually die meningioma-related death, and 32% of patients with a grade 1 lesion, these so-called benign ones, died of meningioma-related death. Reoperation was common, And it's also noted that reoperation pathology is typically associated with increasingly aggressive disease, whether or not the patient has received radiation. And this is observed in several series. Chandra et al. In their surgical series noticed the same thing with independent of extent of resection or growth rate, recurrence portends a worse outcome, and a 10% incidence of histologic degeneration occurs after surgery alone. So the issue is not radiation makes them more aggressive, it's that recurrence lets them be more aggressive regardless of how they're treated upfront, whether or not they get radiation or not. So the take home here is that even benign tumors have skip lesions, that a surgical CTV, as it were, in other words, stripping the dura, is associated with a better long-term control, and that 5 and even 10-year follow-up is not sufficient to assign a cure to a patient. The risk of death from even benign, well-resected meningioma is high, and recurrence portends a more poor prognosis regardless of the initial treatment. In other words, salvage is not as effective as aggressive upfront treatment. At the University of Maryland, it was observed that conformality index was associated with control. Now, conformality index looks at the ratio of irradiated volume to the tumor volume. So the closer that index is to one, the more perfectly conformal the plan is. An index of greater than one suggests that you have essentially a de facto margin around the tumor of dose, and a ratio of less than one would suggest that you are undercovering the lesion with your prescription dose. And they found that a conformality of greater than 1.4 had much better local control than a conformality of less than 1.4. So essentially, the greater the effective margin of dose, the better the control. Now, their conclusion was, therefore, when you do radiosurgery for meningioma, you should put a margin in to include the dural tail. Lee Rogers wrote a letter that's really well worth reading called Chasing Your Dural Tail. And he observed that this dural tail, which is this tapering you see at the end of the meningioma along the dura, is not the dural attachment, which you've spoken about as part of the Simpson resection grading system. The dural tail is just hypervascular dura pathologically. When it's looked at it under the microscope, it's just thickened hypervascular dura. The attachment, the thing that is associated with better control when resected or coagulated, does factor into the Simpson grading system. Tumor islets are not disproportionately represented in the tail. So the notion that we need to include the dural tail, is probably flawed. There's no increased risk of tumor islets being there in the tail as there would be compared to anywhere proximal to the lesion along the dura, even if a tail was not present. Furthermore, trying to include a tail in a radiosurgical plan is most likely going to increase toxicity of the therapy, particularly along a midline structure like this, as we'll see. This raises a concern that to really get adequate control, we might, with radiosurgery, we might really be subjecting the patient to greater toxicity of therapy. So when we turn to the literature and look at radiosurgical series, we have to take into account that the data is typically retrospective, uses different methodologies to distinguish toxicity in particular, but also local control, and is really not very consistent. You'll see that the median follow-up for a lot of these studies is relatively short, typically less than 10 years, which, as we've talked about, is probably not adequate. This last study, which has the longest follow-up, shows an 88% local control and only a 68% 15-year actuarial local control. We spoke about the dangers of looking at actuarial data for lesions that have a propensity for late relapse. 68% is relatively low, and is probably lower still when the crude data is actually looked at. At least as concerning is the increasing amount of data we see that looks at the toxicity of radiosurgery. Remember, radiosurgery was initially looked at as a less toxic way of treating meningioma. And certainly having the appeal of being a much shorter course of therapy. Symptomatic edema, however, for parasagittal lesions seems to be at least as high as 35%. Another series shows that even skull-based lesions are at risk for significant toxicity with radiosurgery, such as intermittent headache and trigeminal nerve dysfunction, as well as other cranial nerve complications. Some trialists have compared radiosurgery to fractionated therapy, using the radiosurgery-like localization of LINAC-based radiosurgery with more conventional fractionation, and show really superior outcomes in terms of toxicity with fractionation. So if we look back again at the Swedish 25-year surgical data, we'll remind ourselves that after gross total resection at 25 years, a large proportion of patients are going to relapse. About a third of patients are going to die a meningioma-related death, even if the patients are grade one at diagnosis. Reoperations are common, and reoperative pathology is increasingly aggressive. This data was presented and then stimulated the authors Osteen and Amder at the University of Florida to look back at their data to see how this compared for patients receiving radiotherapy. They found 149 patients with benign disease and a follow-up of 12 years for all patients. This all occurred in the imaging era after 1984, and patients had at least 10-year non-actuarial follow-up. So again, actuarial follow-up being the problem. What they found is that after recurrence, the risk of recurrence after disease-free survival from radiation of 5 years was only 4%. So if you went 5 years after radiation without recurrence, the chances of recurring later is only 4%. At 10 years, it went down to 3, and 15 years down to 1%. Almost all these patients had visible tumor at the time of radiation. This suggested that the outcomes for these patients treated with radiation were favorable compared to the surgical patients. Overall, 5% developed a recurrence, and when they did look at the actuarial rate, it was 3, 5, and 8% at 10, 15, and 20 years, respectively. Because they had follow-up on all the patients, they were able to look at overall survival and correlate it with relapse-free survival. Terms of treatment planning, having a CT is often helpful in case you have hyperostosis, such as in this case. For grade one meningiomas, we typically will use the gross lesion as the GTV. It's controversial what the CTV should be. Remember, we talked about surgery and the benefit for adding a stripping of the dural margin. We talked about the pathologic correlate behind this. And we talked about what seems to be the problem with radiosurgery in not adding a margin. So typically we'll add a 3 millimeter margin along the dura and then add another couple of millimeters to account for PTV daily setup. We'll do 180 centigray to 5400 centigray, respecting normal structure tolerance. It's controversial how to treat grade 2 lesions. Most agree in a subtotal resection, radiation is warranted. If there's a gross total resection, it's controversial. It's felt that progression-free survival is certainly better after radiation, and this may be important in context of the degeneration at a time of recurrence. Thus, preventing recurrence up front is very important. Again, though, the role after gross total resection is controversial. In terms of planning, use both pre and post MRI, contour the pre-surgical GTV, modify the pre-surgical GTV on post-op scan to take into account any pushing margins as normal structures such as the brainstem will fall back into place post-operatively. We typically contour the post-operative GTV and the gross tumor and put the CTV is 5 millimeters along the dura, avoiding going to the brain parenchyma unless there has been brain invasion, which has in the 2016 WHO criteria upgraded a meningioma to grade 2. So do put a margin on if there is into the parenchyma if there is brain invasion. Consider including involved pre-op dura, particularly if constrained from retreatment by critical structures in the future. You don't want to have to go back and try and treat adjacent to something that's difficult to match. PTV is again based on your system setup and use daily guidance. We typically will take any grade 2 disease to 5940. And cover any bone involvement, again, respecting normal tissue constraints. Grade 3 meningioma, regardless of resection, needs radiation with a second cone down after 5940 to 64 to 66 gray. You can certainly go in fractions of 2 gray, so cone down after 60 gray. You can use RTOG 0539 to treat what they define as intermediate and high-risk meningioma. So recurrent grade 1, subtotally resected grade 2, grade 3, and they use for the GTV the tumor bed enhancement, not an edema and not a dural tail for the reasons we mentioned before. A CTV 60 is the GTV plus a centimeter. The PTV 60 is the CTV 60 plus setup. And it's a dose painting, so at the same time, the CTV 54 will be the GTV plus 2 centimeters, again with a margin for PTV. So in conclusion with meningioma, it's a complicated topic. It should be followed longitudinally. Evidence suggests that a, quote, surgical CTV exists, and we should think about that so there's no disconnect with our radiosurgery or with our radiation approach. Radiosurgery data is still maturing and may, for patients with a otherwise no competing risks of disease, shortchange them in terms of durability. This data is still maturing. Whether or not the low-dose spread that gets to those tumor islets is sufficient is simply unknown and incidental if it is. There's a different toxicity profile between SRS and SRT, and we always must take into account factors, a multitude of factors to account for patients with these potential long-term survival, their competing risks, the risk of side effects, and general health and age. So that will include our review and refresher of tumors of the CNS. And I thank you very much for your attention and time. Also, thanks to Astro for putting this together and inviting me today.